Chapter 13. Hundreds of explosive charges around the rear ventral hull of the frigate went off in the silence of space, throwing sheets of hull plating away into the void. On rails, the thick cylinders of the starship's interstellar drive motors rolled out and fell into the darkness, conduits snapping and trailing jets of coolant liquid, cables arcing with glints of electricity. Crackling orbs of gathered energy spun and cried inside the discarded warp engines. Power that normally would have been channeled into ripping a doorway to the Immaterium had no point of release, and now it churned about itself, faster and faster, spiralling towards critical mass. The Eisenstein leapt away on rods of glittering fusion fire, leaving behind the parts of itself that she had cut loose. As the flexing gravitational output of the warp drives drew the drifting modules together, they sent out whips of brilliant blue-white lightning that lashed blindly, snapping at the frigate's heels. Her void shields glowed but held firm. The true test of them would come in a few seconds. The engine cores began to melt and deform, the power inside them grown to such capacity that it was a self-fulfilling reaction, drawing potency from the differential states between the dimensions of the warp and the common vacuum of real space. Circular sheets of exotic radiation, visible through the entire spectrum, radiated out of the lumpen cluster of matter and energy. Too soon the warp motors had ripped into the madness of the Immaterium, and the rush of force that flooded out was too much, too fast. The reaction collapsed inward, the jettisoned hull panels, the slagged metals, dust and specks of free-floating hydrogen molecules, the very space around it, folding in a final desperate trawl to fuel itself. If there was an eye that could have seen something so abnormal, or glimpsed into a range so far from that of normal sight, an observer might have glimpsed a screaming, clawing beast peering out of the core of the implosion. But then came the detonation. Across barriers of dimension, the catastrophic destruction of the warp motors produced a sphere of radiation that lit space like a dying sun. In the Empyrean, it became a towering shriek, a flash of dead blue, a surge of raw panic and a million other things. In real space, it was a wave of crackling discharge that slammed into the fleeing Eisenstein and threw her bow over stern with murderous lethal force. In the deep shades of the Empyrean, the ragged edge of a shockwave broke upon the preternatural senses of an enhanced mind. The wash of raw input blotted out all other thought sights in an instant of punishing, agonizing overload. It struck the storms of insanity that clung to the mind and tore them away, blasting them apart. The mind was tossed and thrown in the impact, flailing for unending seconds in the turbulent undertow of its passing. Then the flare was gone, fading, leaving only the echo of its creation. Where there had been storms and fog, now there was clarity and lucidity. The mind turned and peered across the wilderness of the Immaterium and found the point of origin. As a flash of night-born lightning might illuminate a darkened landscape, the shockwave made the molten terrain of the warp visible, gave it solidity when all other means of understanding had failed. Suddenly, paths that had been concealed were clear and discernible. The way was abruptly opened, and across the incredible distance, the epicenter of the effect's creation still burned. With care, the mind began to compute a route to take it there, curiosity brimming from every contemplation. Garrow put down the electroquill and ran his gaze down the text rendered on the flat, glassy face of the dataslate. He released a deep breath, and a cloud of white vapour emerged, fading into the cold, thin air of the observatorium. Everything in the chamber was covered in a thin patina of hoarfrost, the steel stanchions and the wide sweeps of the windows painted with patches of white. In the shockwave of the warp flare, several power mechanisms, already stressed by the headlong escape from the Istvan system, failed entirely, and whole decks of the frigate were without life support. Coria had closed the flying bridge and moved the command crew to a secondary control pulpit, leaving the upper deck to go dead and dark. Moment by moment, the Eisenstein was becoming a frozen tomb.
"Captain,"
Cruz said, coming into view, lit by the dull glow of the starlight through the frosted armor glass.
You summon me?
Garrow showed him the data slate.
I want you to witness this.
Nathaniel removed his gauntlet and pressed the commander's signet on his left forefinger to a sensor plate on the slate's case. The device chimed, recognizing the unique pattern of the ring and the gene code of the wearer. He passed it to the Lunar Wolf, and the old warrior paused for a moment, reading what was written there.
A chronicle? Perhaps it would be more accurate to think of it as a last will and testament. I have recorded here all the events of note that preceded our escape from the fleet, and all matters since. There should be a testimony for our kinsmen to find, even if we do not live to deliver it ourselves.
Cruz snorted and mirrored Garrow's actions, sealing the contents of the slate with a touch from his signet.
Planning for the worst. First that boy Sendek, and now you. Death Guard by name, doer by nature, is it?
Garrow took the slate back and secured it in an armored case.
I only wish to cover every eventuality. This container will survive explosion and vacuum, even the destruction of the ship. So, those words on the bridge, then. Your declaration to the apothecary? All that was just an act, Captain. You tell us you know we will survive, but secretly you prepare in case we do not. I did not lie, if that is what you are implying, snarled Garrow. Yes, I believe we will see Terra, but there is no harm in being thorough. That is the Death Guard way. Yet you do this thing out of sight of the men, with only a Lunar Wolf in attendance. Is that perhaps because you would rather not undermine the faith you have kindled in the others?
Garrow looked away.
Age has not dulled your insight, Iacton. You are correct. I understand. In times like this, conviction is all a man can cling to. Before Istvan, we might have looked to our faith in our legions, our primarchs. Now we must find it where we can. The Emperor is still our constant, Garrow said, looking out at the stars. Of that I have no doubt.
Cruz nodded.
Aye, I suppose so. You have made believers of us, Nathaniel. Besides, that chronicle of yours is a wasted effort. How so? The story there is only half told.
Garrow's scarred face turned in a faint smile.
Indeed. I wonder how it will end.
He walked away a few steps, thin rimes of ice crunching under his boots.
Has your saint not told you?
Cruz asked, a note of wry reproof in his words.
She is not my saint, Garrow retorted. Keela is... She has vision. That may be so. Certainly enough of the crew seem to agree. There are many more attending her sermons on the lower decks. I have it on good authority that the iterator Cinderman has moved their makeshift church to a larger compartment among the armory decks to better accommodate them.
Garrow considered this.
Closer to the inner hull spaces. It will be warmer there, more protected. There have been Astartes seen in attendance, Captain. It appears your conference with the woman has given legitimacy to her claims.
Garrow eyed him.
You don't approve? Idolatry is not the imperial way. I see no idols, Iacton, only someone who has a purpose in the Emperor's service, just as you and I do. Purpose? Echoed the Lunar Wolf. That is what this all comes down to, is it not? In the past, we have never had to struggle to find it. Purpose has always been given to us, passed on from Emperor to Primarch to Astartes. Now events force us to seek it alone, and we splinter. Horus finds his in sorcery, and we seek ours in a divinity.
He chuckled dryly.
I never thought I would live to see the like. If your wisdom of years allows you to find another path, tell me of it,
Garrow said firmly.
This way is the only one that opens to me.
Cruz bowed his head.
I would not dare, Battle Captain. I granted you my fealty, and I will follow your commands to the letter. Even if you disagree with them? I saw the reproach in your eyes on the bridge.
You allowed the apothecary to go without him being chastised for his actions. Crewe shook his head. It was a punishable offence towards a senior officer. He drew a weapon on you, Garrow, in anger.
In fear, Garrow corrected. He allowed his emotions to overtake him for a moment. He is chastised by his actions. I won't put a man to the whip for that.
Your warriors question it, pressed the other Astartes. For now, they see it as lenience, but some might think it to be a sign of weakness.
He looked away. Then let them. Brother Voyen is the best apothecary we have. I need him. Decius needs him.
Ah, the Lunar Wolf nodded. It becomes clearer to me. You want the youth to survive.
What I want is to lose no more of my brothers to this madness, snapped Garrow tersely. The rest of my legion may fall to disloyalty or death, but not these men. Not mine.
His breath came out in clouds around him.
Mark me, Yakton Cruz. I will not have the Death Guard become a watchword for corruption and betrayal.
There was a note of genuine pain in the old warrior's words as he looked down at the power armor he wore, still bearing the altered color scheme of the Sons of Horus.
Good luck in that, kinsman, he said quietly. For me, I fear that moment has already passed.
Power routed to the Valetudinarium from other sections of the Eisenstein ensured that the infirmary was kept at a functional level. Garrow was aware that Voyen had initiated a move of all but the most badly injured patients to the deeper levels of the ship, in towards the core of the vessel. The battle captain did not see the Astartes healer as he crossed the chamber, and felt better for it. Despite his words to Cruz, Garrow still smarted at Voyen's actions on the bridge, and he did not want to encounter him again so soon afterwards. It was better that the apothecary kept his distance for the moment. Garrow stepped around an injured officer, whose only inhalations came from a mechanical breather machine, and stopped at the glass pod of the isolation chamber. With care, Garrow took his helmet. The repairs upon it were still visible, unfinished spots where paint had yet to be applied, and sealed it to the neck ring of his armor. Then, after checking the seals on every joint and vent, he locked down the battle suit, preventing any possibility of outside contagions entering his war gear. Garrow passed through the chamber's airlock array and entered the sealed room. A Medicaid servitor tended to Decius with slow, deliberate care. The captain noted that the fleshy components of the machine helot were already grey with infection. Voyen's reports noted that two servitors had died already from slow exposure to whatever poison Grolgor had poured into the youth's wound. It was a testament to the potency of the Astartes' biology that Decius was not dead a dozen times over. Inside the armor, Garrow would be safe, and the stringent purification systems of the isolation chamber would stop any contamination following him out. He had no doubts that the chance of infection still existed, but he would risk it. He had to look the lad in the eye. There on the recovery cradle, Solon Decius lay stripped of his power armor and swaddled in a mesh-like covering of metallic probes and narthesia injectors. The wound where Grolgor's plague knife had cut him was a mess of pustules and livid flesh, on the verge between bilious life and necrotic death. It refused to knit closed, bleeding into a catchbowl beneath the cradle. Portions of Decius's skin were missing, where the Medicaid had plugged feed ducts and mechadendrites directly into the raw nerves. A forest of thin steel needles colonized the thick hide of the black carapace across his torso. Thin white drool looped from Decius's lips, and a pipe forced air into his nostrils with rhythmic, mechanical clicks. The Astartes was an ashen rendition of himself, the colour of a week-old corpse. Had Garrow seen such a body on the battlefield, he would have cast it onto the pyre and let it burn. For a moment, Nathaniel found his hand near the hilt of Libertas, and Voyen's words echoed in his thoughts.
You should consider granting him release.
That would make a lie of what I said to Cruz, he said aloud. The fight is all that we have now. The struggle is what defines us, brother.
Brother.
The voice was so faint that at first Garrow thought he had imagined it, but then he looked down and saw a flicker of motion as Decius's eyes opened into slits.
Solon? Can you hear me, boy?
I can hear you.
His voice was thick with mucus.
I hear it, Captain. Inside me. The thunder in my blood.
Suddenly Garrow's sword seemed to be 10 times its weight.
Solon, what do you want?
Decius blinked, even this smallest of motions appearing to pain him terribly.
Answers, Lord,
he gasped in a breath of air.
Why have you saved us?
Garrow pulled back in surprise.
Oh, I had to, he blurted. You are my battle brothers. I could not let you perish.
Is that the better path?
The wounded warrior whispered.
Unending war between brothers. We saw it, Captain. If that is the future,
then perhaps you would have us embrace death?
Garrow shook his head.
I know your pain is great, brother, but you cannot submit to it. We cannot admit defeat.
He placed his hand on Decius's chest.
Only in death does duty end, Solon. And only the Emperor can grant us that.
Emperor.
The word was a dim echo.
Forsaken. We have been forsaken, my lord. Lost and forgotten. The beast, Grolgor, did not lie. We are alone.
I refuse to accept that.
Garrow's words became a shout.
We will find salvation, brother. We will. You must have faith.
Decius coughed, and the pipes in his mouth gurgled, red-green fluid siphoning away into a disposal tank.
All I have is pain. Pain and loss.
His bloodshot eyes found Garrow and bored into him.
We are lost, my captain. We know not where or when we are. The warp has made sport with us. Cast us into the void.
We will be found.
Garrow's words seemed hollow.
By what, Lord? What if the time we were lost in the Empyrean was not ours, but millennia? The warning. Worthless.
He coughed again, his body tensing.
We may be 10,000 years too late. And our galaxy burns with chaos.
The effort of speaking drained the Astartes, and he sank back into the cradle, the shambling servitor creaking to his side with a fan of outstretched fingers made of syringes and blades. Garrow watched Decius's eyelids flutter closed, and the youth's consciousness slipped away once more. After a long moment, the battle captain turned back to the airlocks and began the arduous process of cleansing his war gear of any lingering taint. When he stepped out of the isolation chamber's outer hatch, he saw Sendek charging towards him across the infirmary, his face tight with tension.
Captain, when I could not reach you, I feared something had happened.
Garrow jerked a thumb at the chamber's thick walls.
The protective field baffles in there are electromagnetically charged. Vox signals won't penetrate inside.
He frowned at the alarm in Sendek's voice.
What is it that requires my attention so urgently? Sir, the Eisenstein sensor grids were badly damaged in the shock from the warp flare and the engagement with Typhon, and we have only partial function. Spit it out,
snapped Garrow. Sendek took a breath.
There are ships, Captain. We have detected multiple warp gate reactions less than 4 light minutes distant. They appear to be moving to an interception heading.
He should have felt elation. He should have been thinking of rescue, but instead Garrow's black mood brought him only imagined terrors and predictions of the worst.
How many craft, mass and tonnage? The sensors gave me only the vaguest of estimates, but it is a fleet, sir. A large one.
Horus, Garrow breathed. Could he have followed us?
Unknown. The ship's external Vox transceiver is inoperable, so we cannot search for any identifier beacons.
Sendek paused.
They could be anything. Anyone. Perhaps an ally, perhaps ships on their way to join the War Master's insurrection, or even Xenos.
And here we sit, blind and toothless before them.
Garrow fell silent, weighing his options.
If we cannot know the face of these new arrivals, then we must encourage them to show it to us. They must have been drawn by the flare. Any commander worth the rank will send a boarding party to investigate. We will allow it, and from there take the measure of them. At their rate of closure, there is little time to prepare, Sendek noted.
Agreed, Garrow said with a nod. These are my orders. Issue weapons to all the crew who know how to use them and get everyone else into the core tiers. Find somewhere they can be protected. I want Astartes at every entry point, ready to repel boarders, but no one is to engage in hostilities unless it is by my word of command.
The armory chambers would be best, mused Sendek. They are heavily shielded. Many of the crew are there already with the woman.
Garrow's lip curled.
Sanctuary in the new church. It seems fitting.
He gathered up his bolter.
Quickly, then. We must be ready to meet our saviours or our assassins with equal vigour.
They crowded about the frigate in the manner of wolves circling a wounded prey animal, observing and considering the condition of the Eisenstein. Sensor dishes and listening gear turned to face the drifting warship, and learned minds attempted to discern the chain of events that had led to its circumstances. Vessels that dwarfed the Imperial frigate placed hordes of armed lance cannons upon the ship's target silhouette, computing firing solutions and warming their guns in preparation for her destruction. Only one volley, and even then not one at full capacity, would be enough to obliterate the Eisenstein forever. It would only be a matter of a single word of command, a button pushed, a trigger pulled. The fleet moved slowly. Some of its number had counselled for the immediate destruction of the derelict, concerned that the flare it had generated to bring them here might only have been a lure. Even a ship the size of a mere frigate, when correctly armed and altered, could become a flying bomb big enough to destroy a battlecruiser. Others were more curious. How had a human vessel come to find itself out here, so far from the rim of known space? What lengths had driven those aboard it to give up their engines in the vain hope of rescue? And what enemies had wrought the damage that scarred the armoured hull? Finally, the predator ships of the war fleet parted to allow the largest of their number to face the Eisenstein. If the frigate was a fox to the wolves of the battleships, then against this craft it became no more than an insect before a colossus. There were moons that massed less than the giant. It was the clenched hand of a god carved from dark asteroid stone, a nickel-iron behemoth, pocked with craters and spiked with broad towers that jutted from its surface. At a great distance, the vessel would have resembled the head of a mace, filigreed with gold and black iron. At close range, a city's worth of spires and gantries reached out, many of them glowing with the light of thousands of windows, others concealing nests of weapons capable of killing a continent. Ships like the Eisenstein were carried in fanged docks around the circumference of the Colossus, and as it drifted closer, the sheer mass of its gravity gently tugged at the frigate, altering her course. Autonomous weapons drones deployed in hornet swarms, staging around the drifting craft. As one, they turned powerful searchlights on the ruined hull and pinned the frigate to the black of the void, drenching her in blinding white beams. Eisenstein's name, still clearly visible atop the emerald sweep of her bow planes, shone brightly with the reflected glow. Inside, a handful of souls waited for their fate to be decided. Haker stepped in from the corridor. A loaded and cocked combi bolter looped over his shoulder on a thick strap.
Outermost decks are all but empty now, Captain, he told Garrow. Vought has rerouted the atmosphere to storage tanks, or down here. Less than a third of the ship has life support, but we won't lack for breathing.
Good. He accepted the sergeant's report.
The men on the promenade decks, they have been withdrawn?
The veteran nodded.
Aye, Lord. I left them there as long as I thought I could, but I've pulled them all back now. I had them spying out through the ports. What with the scrying being out of action and all, I thought that eyeballs were better than no watch at all.
Quick thinking. What did they see?
Haker shifted uncomfortably, as he always did when he had no concrete answer for his commander. Garrow knew this behaviour of old. Anders Haker prided himself on providing accurate intelligence to his battle brothers, and he disliked having only half the facts about anything.
Sir, there were a lot of ships, and they seemed to be of Imperial lines.
Nathaniel's lip curled.
After Istvan, that information only makes me more wary, not less. What else?
The fleet orbits a large construct, easily the size of a star fort, or larger. The brother who laid eyes upon it told me he had never seen such a thing before. He compared it to an orc monstrosity, but not so crude.
Something pushed at the back of Garrow's mind, a half-remembered comment that chimed with the description.
Anything on the Vox?
Haker shook his head.
We are maintaining communication silence as you ordered. If whatever is out there is close enough to broadcast on our battle frequencies, they are choosing not to.
Garrow dismissed him with a nod.
Carry on. We'll wait then.
The battle captain crossed back into the wide space of the armory chamber. Partition walls had been hastily opened along the length to allow the ship's complement of survivors to find purchase here, and from where he stood, Garrow saw a sea of figures huddled in the dim glow of emergency bioloom lanterns. Many on the edges of the group were armed, and they had the air of desperation upon them. With deliberate care, Garrow went in and walked among them, making eye contact with each of the crewmen, just as he would do with his fellow Astartes. Some of the men trembled as he passed them by. Others stood a little taller after the nods he gave them. In all his years of service, Garrow had always thought of the ordinary men of the army as warriors in the same cause as the Astartes, but it wasn't until this moment that he felt anything like kinship with them. Today, we are all united in our mission, he mused. There were no barriers of rank or legion here. He came across Kariah, the dark-skinned officer, cradling a heavy plasma pistol.
Lord Captain, he said thickly.
The shipmaster's face was swollen with his injuries from the escape.
Esteemed master, Garrow returned, I feel I owe you an apology. Oh?
Garrow gestured at the hull walls around them.
You presented me with a fine ship, and I have made such a mess of it.
You need not comment, my lord, Kariah laughed. I have served under your kind in the Great Crusade for decades, and still I think I will never understand you. In some ways you are so superior to men like me, and in others...
His voice trailed off.
Go on, Garrow said. Speak your mind, Barrick. I think our experiences together allow us to be candid.
The shipmaster tapped him on the arm.
In some ways you are like wanton siblings who yearn for a place, for fraternity, but also spark against one another with your rivalries. Like all men, you strive to escape from the shadow of your father, but also to seek his pride. Sometimes I wonder what would happen to you brave, noble lads if you had no wars to fight.
When Garrow didn't reply, Kariah's face fell.
I'm sorry, Captain, I didn't mean to offend you.
You did not, Garrow replied.
Your insight is challenging, that is all.
He thought for a moment.
As to your question, I do not know the answer. If there were no wars, what use would weapons be?
He pointed to Kariah's pistol and then himself.
Perhaps we would make a new war, or turn upon each other. Where's Horus did?
A chill washed through Garrow's soul.
perhaps.
The thought lay heavy upon him, and he turned, forcing it away. Garrow found Sendek and Haker scrutinizing an Auspex unit. With the aid of Vought, Sendek had been able to connect the device to some of the Eisenstein's external sensory mechanisms.
Captain, a reading.
Garrow dismissed Kariah's words from his mind and snapped back to battle focus.
A report? Energy build-up, said Haker. For a second, I thought it might have been a deep scan of the hull, but then it changed.
A complex waveform writhed across the Auspex screen.
A scan?
He glanced at Sendek.
Could we be detected in here through this much iron and steel?
It is possible, replied the Astartes. A vessel with enough power behind her sensors could burn through any amount of shielding.
A ship, or something like a starfort,
added Haker. Cold realization seized Garrow's chest, and he snatched the Auspex from Sendek's grip. The pattern. He knew what it was.
To arms!
He bellowed, his voice echoing around the chamber.
To arms! They're coming in!
The Auspex forgotten, Haker and Sendek brought up their weapons and panned them around the compartment. At Garrow's words, the crew surged with panic. He saw Kariah snap out commands, and the men brought their guns to the ready.
So, what is it? Sendek asked. There!
Garrow pointed into the centre of the chamber, to an open area just inside the doors where Haker had arranged a staggered barricade. A low humming, like electric motors deep beneath the earth, was issuing from the air, and static prickled at the battle captain's skin. Embers of emerald radiance danced and flickered across the deck. For one moment, recalling the strange warp things that had come to the ship in the depths of the Empyrean. But this was something different. This time, Garrow knew exactly what to expect.
No man opens fire until I give the word,
he shouted. And then they came. With a thundering roar of splitting air molecules, a searing flash of jade lightning exploded across the middle of the armory chamber floor, the backwash of colour throwing stark, hard-edged shadows over the walls and ceiling. Garrow raised his hand to shield his eyes from the brilliance before it could dazzle him into temporary blindness. Then the light and noise were gone with a flat crack of displaced atmosphere, and the teleportation cycle was complete. Where there had been bare deck and scatterings of discarded equipment, now there was a cohort of stocky, armoured figures in a perfect combat wheel deployment. A ring of 8 Astartes, resplendent in battle gear that shimmered in the light of the biolooms, stood with their bolters ranged at their shoulders, with none of the chamber unguarded. One of them spoke with a voice clear and hard, in the manner of a man used to being obeyed instantly.
Who is in command here?
Garrow stepped forward, his weapon at his hip and his finger upon the trigger.
I am.
He saw the speaker now, his head bare. He picked out a hard face, a humourless aspect, and behind him? What was that behind him?
You will stand down and identify yourself.
In spite of the tension inside him, something in Garrow rebelled at the superior tone, and he sneered in reply.
No, he spat. This is my vessel, and you have boarded it without my authority.
Abruptly, all the strain and anger that he had kept locked away inside him over the past few days roared back to the fore, and he poured every last drop of it into his retort.
You will stand down. You will identify yourself. And you will answer to me.
In the silence that followed, he caught a murmur. And as one, the muzzle of every bolter the boarding party held dropped downward to point at the decking. The warrior who had addressed Garrow bowed and stepped aside to allow another figure, the shape he had glimpsed at the centre of the group, to step forward. Garrow's throat tightened as a towering shape in yellow-gold armour came into the light. Even in the feeble glow of the lanterns, the raw presence of the new arrival lit the room. A severe and uncompromising gaze surveyed the chamber from a grim face, framed by a snow-white shock of hair, a face that seemed as hard and unyielding as the mammoth plates of golden-hued brass that made the man a walking statue. But no, not a man.
Primarch!
He heard the whisper fall from Haker's mouth. Any other words died forming in Garrow's throat. He found he could not draw his sight away from the warlord's armour. Like Garrow's, the warrior wore a cuirass detailed with eagles spread over his shoulders and across his chest. Upon his shoulder pauldron was a disc of white gold, and layered to that, cut together from sections of blue-black sapphire, was the symbol of a mailed gauntlet, clenched in defiant threat. Finally, the diamond-hard eyes found Garrow and held him.
"Pardon our intrusion, kinsman," said the demigod,
his words strong and firm, but not raised in censure.
"I am Rogaldorn, master of the 7th Legionis Astartes, Emperor's son and Primarch of the Imperial Fists."
He found his voice again.
"Garrow, Lord, I am Battle Captain Nathaniel Garrow of the Death Guard, commanding the starship Eisenstein."
Dorn nodded gently.
"I request permission to come aboard, Captain. Perhaps I may be of some assistance."